evening, everyone. This is the Reverend Blake Ruby. Welcome to my show, The Church of the Soul's Evolution. I hope you're doing all right. I am doing well, thanks to God. Here in San Antonio, the sun has gone down. And even though, and I mentioned this on the previous show, even though the weather is getting colder and we still have about a month or two of winter left, it seems like the sun is setting later every day. I don't quite understand that, but I guess it's all right. Anyway, I was talking with Thomas before the show, and I was telling him that I officially retired from the U.S. Army with almost 44 years of service. The 31st of December was my last day. I took the early out, early retirement, and so I've actually been on retirement status since the 10th of March. I was since the 10th of March, and then on 31 December, it became official. So I had all those months, 9 months, getting paid full-time pay on administrative status, and I'm very grateful for that. So altogether, I served 22 years active duty, 4 years in the infantry, and 18 years as an administrative specialist. In other words, a clerk typist. And then I retired in 2004. And I was a contractor with a company called MPRI, who works for the military. And I was with them for 4 years. And then I switched over to Booz Allen Hamilton, a subsidiary of theirs actually called Caliber, for a little over 2 years. And then I became a Department of the Army civilian in 2010. I moved here to San Antonio. And so altogether, over 15 years and 8 months, if you include my sick leave, 4 months of sick leave, which is tacked on to the end of my total time of service. So, as I mentioned, almost 44 years working for the Army. One thing I learned that the Army taught me during that time, and I'm very grateful for the life that the Army gave me. At one time, I wasn't going anywhere. My life was heading in no direction. My father was in the British Army in World War II at Normandy and Dunkirk, and he had some serious PTSD, by the way. And my mother went through the bombing of London. My parents were English. They used to speak like this, you know, jolly good show. But after the war, they migrated to Canada, and my sister was born in 1952, and 2 years later, I was born. So going through the Canadian school system, I never learned to speak like my parents did. And I was a bellman in a hotel in San Diego. But before that, let me go all the way back to the beginning. I was a linen boy in a hotel in it was in Hotel Circle in 1973. We just moved there. I had graduated from the American High School in Guadalajara, Mexico. Did my 11th and 12th grade there. Let me go back even further, just to get a little more of a story. I won't go all the way back to the beginning of my life, but my parents and I lived in Ottawa, Canada in 1971. Dad had just retired from the Canadian Army. So after World War II, he joined the Canadian Army when he migrated to Canada and retired in 1966. We were living in Nashwauksis, New Brunswick, Canada when he retired. And then we moved to Ottawa in 1968. So it was on a cold January night, around about this time in 1971, when we loaded up our brand new 1963 Pontiac with all of our possessions and two cats, and my parents and me. My sister had moved out before then. She was living on her own. We moved to Guadalajara, drove all the way south of the Canadian border through the United States, 600 miles south of the Mexican-American border in a beautiful city called Guadalajara. And indeed, it is very beautiful with all the roses everywhere and fountains on the sides of the roads. And it's 5,200 feet above sea level. The weather there was perfect. It's one of the best climates in the world, in as much as it's very temperate, doesn't get too cold, doesn't get too hot. San Diego is like that also. So I spent 2.5 years in Guadalajara, and I could keep on talking and tell you all about my time there, but let me get a little fast forward to San Diego. After I graduated from high school, we moved to San Diego. I lived there 9.5 years, excuse me, 9 years. And my parents had moved to Las Vegas. 6 months later, I joined them there in Las Vegas, and I was unemployed. I had worked going back to the when I first moved to San Diego. I got a job working as a linen boy at the, I forget the name of the hotel. It was in Hotel Circle in San Diego, and that was over the summertime. And then I began junior college. I did 2 years of junior college. I got about 50 some plus credits, which eventually I applied towards my Bachelor of Science degree. And after that hotel, I went to another hotel, got a part-time job as a bellman, like I was saying. And I worked that part-time as I was going through college. And then in 1976, in February of 76, I got a full-time job as a bellman at one of the best hotels in San Diego, the Hyatt Hotel on Mission Bay. And I worked that job for 6 years. And my parents, as I mentioned, my parents had moved to Las Vegas, and I wanted to change things in my life. I realized that that job wasn't taking me anywhere. I didn't want to be a bellman for the rest of my life. And I moved in with my parents in Las Vegas, and I was unemployed. And my father said, "Well, why don't you join the Canadian Navy? Joining the military is always a good idea." Well, that didn't work out, so I tried to join the U.S. Air Force. However, I was going to take a drink. Just a few months too old. So I went to the Army, and the next thing I knew, I was in the Army and heading to basic training and advanced individual training, beginning at Fort Jackson and winding up in Fort Benning, Georgia. As I mentioned, I was with the infantry for 4 years, so I went through infantry basic training and AIT. And my first assignment was over in Germany, at Aschaffenburg, with the 1st and the 4th Infantry for 2 years. And then I went to Fort Polk, Louisiana. While I was in Aschaffenburg with the 1st and 4th Infantry, I was with a 81 millimeter mortar platoon. At Fort Polk, I was with a 107 millimeter, otherwise known as Four Deuce mortar platoon. And very dangerous, shooting those rounds off the track, carrier mounted track, or that what they called it, the mortar was mounted on the track. Two different kinds of tracks, very similar and very easy to get injured or killed even doing these live fires. And also driving down the roads, dirt roads in the training areas at nighttime on blackout drive where you have, you're not supposed to use your lights or you use blackout marker or you can barely see. It just helps people to recognize you as you're going down the road, but you can't see and you're traveling like 40 miles an hour on these huge 10, 11 ton machines. It's very dangerous. So I did my 4 years and then I reclassified to administrative specialist. The point of what I was trying to say is that when I was in the Army, I was so glad that I did join because it gave me purpose. Over the years, I worked my way up through the ranks. And when I retired, I was E7 Sergeant First Class. And then I got a job as a contractor. I continued working for the Army. And all the men and women that I used to work with were so awesome, the best leaders that you'll ever meet. And that leads me to the next point. I would recommend for every young man and woman to join the military. In some countries, it's mandatory. Why? Because they teach you one of the most important virtues, and that is discipline. Discipline in your life is so important nowadays. Do things right, do things properly, be on time, to live your life in a certain routine and not deviate from what your goals are. You know what I'm saying? And if all the men, young men and women in our society and other societies around the world where they don't make it mandatory for young men and women to do a 2-year stint in the military, it would be so advantageous to them. The world would be a much better place. And I say that because I see all the protesters, rioters on television, and hey, they're getting their day on television. That's another thing that inspires people to do these things because they get their face on television. Not a good thing. Television, actually, in my opinion, can be a curse sometimes. Other times it's enjoyable. I really do like sitting down and watching television. It's kind of like a trip through the past. And you learn some good information if you watch the right channels, but other channels like the news channels, they're really negatively, they have a negative, how shall I put it? Well, simply that they can be very negative and not have a lot of positivity. And I think that I would recommend that we not watch too much news because, and my wife, she watches news. I don't want to say anything bad about my wife, but she admires the people who broadcast the news. And I do too. They're very intelligent and fun people, I can tell, even though they get involved with the competition. You watch one channel like Fox or CNN, and they're very locked in horns, so to speak, competing with each other. And competition really rules this world. The people and the animals are constantly in competition for food and otherwise. But these rioters, these protesters, they had the right to protest. I have no problem with that. But in my opinion, it should be peacefully and with respect for law enforcement. And that's another thing I wanted to say about the military. You have the values of the army, which are loyalty, duty, respect, selfless service, integrity, moral courage. And the greatest of those is respect, in my opinion. Every human being is deserving of respect, but especially law enforcement officers whose lives are on the line constantly. There's a lot of them that get killed, and they're just doing their jobs. Yes, I know some are bad apples. There's always bad apples everywhere, but the majority of police, law enforcement slash ICE agents are good, decent people who are doing their jobs to uphold the law. And even beyond that, they are controlled by whatever administration is in power. And the majority of voters voted in the Trump administration back in 2024. 79 million people voted for Mr. Trump. And Mr. Trump is trying to enforce the immigration laws throughout our country and is getting a lot of resistance. I see both sides to this. Respect and obeying commands of the police and law enforcement is so important. And that's what I learned in the military, to obey orders. Now, they're not always right orders, Perhaps. I mean, I don't know if I would obey the order to charge that machine gun up there in a bunker, if I was in a combat situation, because I might get me killed. But some people do, You have to have that trust in your leaders and that respect to obey command. You remember that movie, A Few Good Men? Now, I don't believe everything that Colonel Jason Nathan Jessup said, and he was basically a good man who did what he thought was right by ordering the code red. For those of you familiar with the movie, he said there in the court scene that, "Son, we obey orders or people die." And that, with a few exceptions, is generally speaking true. When you're in the military, you obey orders and you learn respect. Respect for your superiors, respect for everyone. In other societies around the world, like in Japan, they respect their elders. If you've ever been to Japan, and we're going again in April, I bought my ticket the other day. We went there in August of last year. They're a very controlled, laid back, quiet society. There's hardly any crime. Why? Respect. Respect. You don't have active shooters there. Here in the United States, you have a lot of active shooters. Now, I understand that the United States is a melting pot of diversity, people from all over the world, and freedom is on everyone's lips. We get a lot of lip service towards freedom, and that's a good thing. Freedom is. And I understand that in order to achieve complete freedom, that we have to go through some of these growing pains, so to speak. But a lot of these active shooters are people with mental health issues, kind of like the lunatic fringe, if you will, with all due respect. And a lot of these protesters, whether they were from the January 6th riot or these ones going on in the streets of Minnesota, these people, why aren't they working? Don't they have jobs? How can they throw things at the law enforcement people who are legally law enforcement people and not expect them to maybe fire tear gas or pepper spray them? Respect, my friend. It all comes down to respect. Would you do that to your, if you got pulled over by a policeman in your own city or town where you live? Do you disrespect the police wherever you are? No, I don't think you do. There are some outlaws out there, as I mentioned, the extreme right fringe, extreme left fringe, that maybe just want to get some publicity, get on television. I don't like how they're being disrespectful to police officers. I have the greatest respect for police officers. Theirs is a very difficult job, and they don't get paid a lot of money. And they have to deal. I rode with a police officer one day when I lived in Alexandria, Virginia, because I was teaching his son Spanish. I was tutoring his son in Spanish. I'm going to take a drink. And you get to see the very lowly side of life. A lot of degenerate people, with all due respect, people who are poor or homeless or alcoholics or drug users, they get to see a lot of that. And they don't deserve to be spat upon or have things thrown at them. They're just doing their job, and they have feelings and emotions too. And they have to control those. Now, in regard to Renee Good, who got shot, well, I see it from both sides of the coin. That particular ICE agent almost got run over by a vehicle before. And there have been some accounts of law enforcement officers who have got dragged by a car and killed and severely injured. I think, personally, in my opinion, that he could have done something else besides shooting into the car, because even though she pointed her car in his direction, it was easy for him to sidestep it. It's not like he was directly in front, in the grill area. and she was going to run him over, and he would have gone underneath the car. It wasn't that bad. So I think he could have maybe shot out the tires or shot a warning shot or two in the air, taking down her license plate, and had her arrested later. But killing her, that was a bit extreme, in my opinion. Still, I saw the video of her and her wife, and they were disrespectful and rude to police officers. And as I mentioned, that is something in our society that we need to learn. I'm not saying that the Japanese and their societies are better than ours, but at least they've learned to be respectful, and the result is less crime, which is a good thing, right? Also, less active shooters, good thing, right? And people, I've seen other Japanese people, I've been walked among them, and they're very friendly. They keep to themselves, but when you engage them, they're so friendly. And our society, we can learn. America, yes, it's the greatest country in the world, and it's a superpower, but we could learn more things from other countries. We really need to keep our minds open and strive to be the best version of ourselves if possible. I'm going to take a drink. So, in summary, I would say, always be respectful to every human being. If you're going to throw something at people, like I saw protesters throwing snowballs at some ICE agents. In my opinion, when they do that, they're inviting either to be pepper sprayed or have tear gas sent in their direction or be arrested. I understand people want to make a point, but let me ask you another question. Do you think any one of those protesters there in Minneapolis is a Republican? No, they're all Democrats. And we need to really get away from that. We need to find a middle ground, so we can get back to being American and respecting and loving each other like we know how to and we can. We're smart enough, I would like to say a prayer for Renee Goodsoul because it seems like she was a good person, That little video clip I saw of her, she seemed like a very vivacious, loving person, full of life, with three children, I think, and I'm sorry that that had to happen to her. Some of these law enforcement officials, they have to make split-second decisions, if they feel that their lives are threatened. But I think, in my opinion, they really need to revise their training. Just like before with all the people that were killed by police officers, George Floyd and others, where they could have been tasered instead of shot, or maybe shot in the leg, or a warning shot, or, shoot the tires out of the car. That's easy. All you got to do is just aim your gun at the tires and boom, they can't go anymore, right? Two tires, especially. So I really think they need to do better training. But respect, just obey the command, law enforcement. These are our leaders. They're excellent leaders. I went on post today to do my workout, and I drove by three men, military police, on the front gate. And I've seen them, along with drill sergeants and officers. They are the best leaders in the military. They are sharp. They are responsible. They have integrity. They have selfless service duty. They're loyal. They embody all the values of the military, my friends. I would encourage anyone to join the military, even just for a couple of 4 years. You can learn so much. You learn camaraderie, team spirit, working as a team. It's so important. But more than anything else, you learn to respect each other and respect your superiors, just like you respect your elders. They're supposed to, like they do in Japan. Respect your elders. Why? Because they have more experience, and more experience is greater wisdom in life matters. Yes, your experience is different than theirs, but you can still learn from them. You can take whatever you want from whatever they tell you and learn from it. Join the military. Plus, you get the Montgomery GI Bill. So after you've done your stint, if you don't want to stay in, you could go to college and get a degree. It's a good deal. I'm going to take a drink. I don't have anything against protesting, as I mentioned, but it should be done peacefully. You know, have your sign. Be polite. There's no need to write vulgar words on signs. And I understand the nature of the competition. You know, Mr. Trump won the election back in 2024. The majority of Americans decided that the Republicans were going to govern the country for the next 4 years. In my opinion, everyone should be on board with that. Be a good sportsman, just like you're watching a game. Maybe you might be a LA Rams fan or a Carolina Panthers fan. But if you lose, accept that. Go watch another team play, you know, get your mind off it. So where is the sportsmanship? You know, you lost, drive on. Set your sights on the next election. Start working that. Find your superstar to be your representative. Work towards it. Go knock on doors, whatever. Contact your congressman. That's another thing to do. If you don't like law enforcement, you can become a congressperson. You can contact your congressperson. Contact a local radio or TV station to report your complaint, you know. Or go to a court to get a ticket and appeal it. Well, the officer he hit me, whatever. And do it that way. Don't, you know, set cars on fire and loot stores and be making a lot of noise and people are trying to sleep. That's rude and disrespectful. We need to have respect and be courteous in our society because we're all in this together, you know. I understand some people don't have jobs and you've got nothing better to do, but why aren't you out looking for a job? Rather than joining, you know, like a street gang, that's what they're like. Do you think any decent, hardworking, family-oriented person is out there protesting the way they do in Minneapolis right now and other places like they've done in the past or will do again in the future? No. These are the fringe, extreme people. And maybe people with mental health issues, too. Again, the bottom line I would say is have respect for your fellow human beings, especially law enforcement people. Obey their commands, whether you like it or not. These are people who are doing their job. They're told to do it. They don't have anything personal. Be respectful to them. Their lives are on the line. Have you ever watched cops? They have to chase people sometimes, high-speed chases. And you know how dangerous those are and how that endangers other people's lives. And they have to keep their cool and emotions. They're chasing somebody for like 20, 30 miles, going 100 plus miles an hour. I don't blame them for wanting to like really seriously kick their butts, so to speak, if you know what I mean, afterwards. I can feel their emotions. I've seen one of those chases before. Endangering other people's lives, you know. That's what they have to go through. They go through a lot and don't get paid that much money, you know, for being a policeman. You don't get paid a lot. I'm going to take a drink. Time to break out. New bottle of water. Hold on, please. But I always see really good virtues in police officers. I see the leadership. I see the values in them. I see the respect. I see the discipline. I see the calm dignity, having to deal with all kinds of bad situations, and the lower side of life that you and I don't see too often. They have to deal with that. We shouldn't demonize them, Anyway, how about I change the subject? Gonna take a drink. When I was in the infantry, I almost died one time. And let me tell you what happened. I was on a training exercise with the mortar platoon, and we were on a live fire, which means that we were firing mortar rounds downrange. And the 81 millimeter round is by no means a firecracker. It's high explosive stuff, that has a 35 meter killing radius. In other words, if it landed within 35 meters of you, or within 35 meters, you'd be killed, either by the shrapnel or the explosion. So these are very dangerous rounds that we were shooting down range. And so we had this exercise where we had to fire as many rounds as we could down range. Actually, I think we had a limit like 15, but we had to do it as quickly as we could. I had to work my way up through the ranks. You begin by being a driver of the armored personnel carrier, which is really cool. They're fun to drive. You have laterals, you turn one to the left, it turns left, turn one to the right, it turns right. And also, along with that title, you have the title of ammo bearer, which means you hand the rounds of ammunition to the assistant gunner and the gunner on the mortar track. And I'd been promoted. I worked my way up to assistant gunner. The squad leader, also you have a squad leader. So you have the squad leader, gunner, assistant gunner, and driver, ammo bearer. And I was taking my first time at being an assistant gunner, which means I was handing the actually, I was putting the rounds down the tube, and we did something we weren't supposed to do, and that was for the gunner and me, the assistant gunner, to alternate putting rounds down the tube. So I would hand one to him, and I can't remember if we had some rounds on the other side, but we were putting them down the tube, alternating, and I put one, and it was fast. I think I said that we had 15 rounds to shoot in a short period of time. And I lost track of exactly when the round was coming out. And I put one on top of one that was coming out, just barely ticked the edge of the round in my hand, and it slid out of my hand. Excuse me, let me take a drink. It slid out of my hand and went landed on the track, the top of the track. And it tilted, it teetered on the edge, it didn't fall over, but it wouldn't have blown up because they have to spin so many times before they arm themselves before they explode. But in the meantime, the charges at the bottom of the round exploded, and wasn't a lot. There's just a little bit of gunpowder there, but my right wrist on the inside had flecks of blood from the explosion of the charge round, the charge bags. But it was very close to me, and it bent some of the fins at the end of the mortar round. If I had just another second, it might have exploded. And they come out of the round, the tube very fast. The round comes out of the tube very fast. And I could have lost my hand or some fingers. My father in World War II lost two fingers on his left hand because he got hit by a German recoilless rifle. And the rest of his hand was kind of like a claw, and he couldn't use it too well. He was very self-conscious about that, but I almost had the same thing, similar thing happened to me. So we called a ceasefire, and we were kind of looking at each other like, whoa, that was a close one. And the guy came over and said, well, hey, don't worry about it. I'm glad you're driving on in good warrior fashion. Don't worry about it. Don't let it happen again. And it's okay. That made me feel better. In retrospect, I understand that that was my first time as an assistant gunner, and also we shouldn't have been sharing, putting rounds down at the same time. That was against the rules and procedures. So I don't really blame myself too much for that. Anyway, I'm now officially retired, as I mentioned, and I told Thomas at the beginning of the show, before the show began, that I'm working on getting some additional disability from the Veterans Administration. I don't know if I might have mentioned this. Well, I have mentioned it on a previous show, but I don't remember when. In 1995, when I was on active duty, my son, let me go back a year. In 1994, my son was born in Monterey, California. I was in Turkey at the time doing a tour, a 15-month tour. And when my son was born, he was born with underdeveloped kidney. So kidney disease, in other words. And not surprisingly, my ex-wife, now my ex-wife, I have another wife now, her father died of kidney disease at a young age. I think it was 40. So my son's kidneys were underdeveloped because what happened was during his fetal development, there was a blockage in the ureter, and that stunted the growth of the kidneys because the urine backed up into the kidneys and stunted their growth. So at age 2 days, he was taken from Monterey to the Children's Hospital in Stanford University in San Francisco, and they did what they call a phlebotomy, which is where they cut the skin behind the kidneys in the back to allow the urine to drain out. And the plan was him to go eventually to get onto dialysis and later transplantation. So, not surprisingly, after 3 months, one of the kidneys, and we were hoping they would grow too. We used to say, grow kidneys, grow. And we'd be praying to God for the kidneys to grow. But as I mentioned, not surprisingly, one of them became infected. You could actually pull the skin back and look way down deep inside. And so at age 3 months, he was put on peritoneal dialysis. And they asked me if I'd be willing to donate one of my kidneys. And I said, yes, I would. I'm his father. It's a no-brainer. My wife couldn't, my ex-wife, because she had a history of kidney disease in her family. And she was borderline diabetic anyway at the time. So I went through the testing. The blood test worked out all right because I was O positive and that's a universal donor. Tissue testing turned out to be positive, or in other words, that we were a match. And so we began the preparation for me to eventually donate one of my kidneys. And so one of those steps was for him to get big enough to take the kidney in his body, because at that time he was only 3 months. So from age 3 to 10 months or 7 months, he was on peritoneal dialysis. And we had to get him up to 18 pounds of weight. At the time, he was throwing up a lot because that was the nature of dialysis. Are you familiar with peritoneal dialysis? what that process is. They pump a fluid into the abdominal area through a tube which has been implanted into the abdomen, and then it sits there for a period of time, and then it's sucked out into like a container, and it's like urine. And this fluid that they pump in kind of draws the impurities out of the blood, so much like a regular kidney, what it does to filter the blood. And a person goes through several of these cycles during the course of the nighttime. And in other words, you plug into the machine at approximately 10 o'clock at night for 8 hours. And then at 6 o'clock in the morning, you unplug from it and stop up the tube, which you keep taped to your abdominal area. And for a baby to have to go through that, it was tough because it kind of wreaked havoc with the digestive system. Additionally, he had to drink formula, you know, and he was not holding down all of the formula that we were giving him. So we had to pump formula into his stomach through a tube called an NG tube. We had the little machine right next to his bed, and it would pump the formula into his stomach, and then sometimes he'd throw that up. And in the middle of the night, we'd have all these alarms going off for the dialysis machine and the calorie machine, and it would throw up in the bed, and they would have a poopy diaper too. And so we were up and down during the night, and that went on for several months until on the 29th of March, 1995, while I was on active duty, I donated one of my kidneys to my son in an operation at Stanford University's Children's Hospital. They took my right kidney and put it in my son, who was 10 months old at the time and weighed 18 pounds. He had just reached the minimum weight. And if you look at your fist, if you ball up your fist, that's about the size of a regular kidney. And so it fit pretty perfectly into his center abdominal area. You know, they had to make an incision all the way down his chest, down to the lower abdominal area. And so the kidney fit in there, and it lasted them 19 years. Anyway, me, afterwards, I had they had cut an incision on my right side, 9 inches long. Now these surgeries are less invasive, and I would encourage anyone to donate a kidney to someone, especially a family member who's in need. It's been now 31 years since I donated one of my kidneys, and I'm doing okay. I had to make some changes, you know, to my diet. You know, less fat, less sugar, less salt, that kind of thing. I became a vegan, vegetarian person, then a vegan, because it's all about digestion, you know. Food that's easy to digest kind of ensures the longevity of the remaining kidney. According to my research, I might be wrong. Then again, I might be right. And it's worked for me over the years. I haven't had too many issues. However, that scar where they cut me open has been a source of a lot of my disabilities that I get paid for from the VA, VA disability, in other words, because it hampers my movement to the left, to the right, up and down. I've got kind of like a little inner tube on my right side. So GERD, I got disability for GERD, disability for the scar, PTSD and anxiety associated with the kidney donation, and sleep apnea. Because I can only sleep on my back. I can't sleep on my side. something to do maybe with only help, having one remaining kidney. But for years now, I haven't been able to sleep on my side. I have to sleep on my back, which is not ideal for my wife. They have to listen to me snore, but I found that I've been incompatible with a CPAP machine, and I've tried the dental therapy device. I tried a wedge pillow, tried nasal dilators. Right now, I just try to eat the right diet, exercise properly. I get exercise every day, and I breathe through my nose when I exercise. I do some brisk walking and also some running. Today I did 100 meter run, breathing through my nose only. And so I'm trying whatever I can do holistically to survive. There is no long-term research about kidney donation as to, if one can live like a normal person with the same amount of time, in other words, our entire life. A lot of doctors say that a person can live a normal life with only one kidney, but there is no long-term research that suggests that. So I've been kind of on my own trying to determine the right way of doing things in all aspects of my life. But regarding the VA, there's something I'm working with them right now for some additional disability, and that is the loss of a kidney. I'm going to take a drink. When I took my retirement physical back in 2004, when you get out of the military, they ask you, okay, what is wrong with you? And you annotate everything that you know about. Maybe you had an injury when you're in service and you broke a leg, and later on, you might have aggravated it from physical training or being in the infantry, jumping off an armored personnel carrier, that kind of thing. Or you might have sleep apnea, so you get tested while you're still in service, and then when you get out, they can give you disability for that. And anything that you can think of so that you can get compensated for that and have it service connected to your service. Anyway, I was denied the service connection for the loss of a kidney because they said it was elective surgery. So that's what we're fighting right now. Our contention is that no, it wasn't elective. Elective surgeries are like LASIK surgery or a vasectomy, hysterectomy, cosmetic surgeries. My surgery was done to save my son's life. That's really the bottom line. He was 10 months old at the time. He had been on peritoneal dialysis for seven months. The waiting list for a kidney transplant was 5 years. He was already having a hard time, with the throwing up all the time. He couldn't have survived another 5 years. My wife couldn't, ex-wife couldn't donate one of her kidneys, as I mentioned, because she had kidney disease in her family and she was borderline diabetic. So it was up to me to save my son's life. And I did. I gave him one of my kidneys. Well, it really wasn't elective surgery, it was an emergency surgery. Additionally, I think that when someone is in the military, you kind of belong to them, your body, your life. When you join the army or whatever service, you're kind of signing a contract for everything up to and including your life. I mean, you might go to war, be sent to combat. So everything inside your body, including your body, or other way around, your body and including everything inside your body belongs to the government, if you will. And so the loss of the kidney And this is another point of view. It should really be considered part of duty. You know, service connection, I had to have it approved by my chain of command and went all the way up to the top, to the Surgeon General of the Army, where they approved it. So if it was elective surgery, theoretically, I didn't need to have it approved. If it had been elective surgery, like LASIK surgery or vasectomy or some other kind of elective surgery. So we're waiting to find out what the VA is going to rule. If they deny it again, they've denied it lots of times. They've even said that it didn't happen when I was in service. No kidding. Like about at least three times they said that it didn't even happen, even though it's in my record. And that's not very cool, in my opinion. I mean, I'm very grateful to be a 100% disabled veteran. Very grateful for that. But the trouble that I've had with the VA over the years and the denials and the nonsense, the repeated denials without really considering. Fortunately, I've had a lawyer to help me. But it's been very aggravating, and it hasn't been what I would call good customer service from the VA, especially saying that the kidney donation hadn't happened. At least three times they denied the appeals that we submitted based on it not happening when I was in service. And I mean, sometimes so ridiculous that I've been very frustrated, you know, and my lawyer too. But eventually they did approve the PTSD and anxiety and the scar and the GERD. And now we're looking for the loss of the kidney. Also, there is fatigue associated with the kidney donation. And that's because I've noticed, and I did notice, that right after the kidney donation, I no longer had the energy or the desire to run like I used to. And I was a very good runner when I was in the Army. In fact, all the PT tests, physical training tests that I used to take, up until that time, I had gotten a perfect score on every one of them, a total of 9 in a row. So 300, you know, 100 points for the push-ups, 100 points for the sit-ups, 100 points for the 2-mile run. And then after the kidney donation, I was told to walk for a few months to get the feeling back in that area there because it cut off the nerves. As I mentioned now, the surgeries are less invasive, so they don't have a 9-inch scar like what happened to me in 1995. And all those nerves that were cut, you know, had to grow back. It took years before I had feeling restored to that area of my body, that lower right abdominal area. Okay, here's a prayer, my friends. That went kind of fast. Creator of the universe, God, we love you. Thank you for everything. Please bless us, everyone. Help us to grow and evolve. You are awesome and wonderful. We will worship you and adore you forever. You're so worthy. We exist because of you. Thank you for everything. Thank you for your love. Amen. Goodbye, everybody. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.